The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodkey for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the March-April 2023 issue. We begin with our main story, Space Aging. Microgravity deteriorates the body in surprisingly familiar ways. Space travel is now informing health research for Earthbound seniors and astronauts alike. While paging through the book Space Physiology and Medicine in 1995, Senator John Glenn spotted a chart that captured his imagination. Listed were 52 kinds of physical changes routinely experienced in space by orbiting astronauts, including osteoporosis, cardiovascular difficulties, and alterations in the distribution of bodily fluids. The 73-year-old Glenn, who had spent years on the Senate Special Committee on Aging, realized that he was looking at a list of complaints common to seniors, yet the typical astronaut was in their 30s, 40s, or 50s. Given the similarities, Glenn wondered if there were any plans to fly senior citizens into space. He called the authors of the publication, along with other space doctors, to find out. To his surprise, despite shuttle missions going up every few months, nobody knew of any plans to send an elderly person into orbit. "I wondered why the science had to wait," Glenn wrote in his autobiography. "Why couldn't room be made on one of them for some experiments on senior citizens? And then I began to think, why not me?" Early in his career, Glenn trained as a Marine and was an accomplished test pilot, breaking numerous flying records before being scooped up by NASA in the very first astronaut recruitment drive. Famous for his clean-cut image and charm, he was a favorite to be the first to fly in space. Indeed, he was on NASA's first orbital mission, Friendship 7, in 1962. But his plans for a return to space were stymied by the Kennedy administration, which deemed Glenn too valuable a national hero for such a trip. So Glenn left NASA and moved into politics, never expecting that the chance for space travel would come up again. Several things played into Glenn's favor as he lobbied NASA in 1995 for a flight opportunity. The agency was, of course, wary of sending a senior into space, let alone one as famous as Glenn, a politician for decades. Yet NASA did have 42 years of data on the astronaut who had consented to regular medical checks under an agency program for retired astronauts. Glenn was also in remarkably good health, with one Washington Post report describing him as one very fit, lifelong jet jockey who power walks 2 miles a day on Earth and has passed all his pre-flight physical tests. Glenn told NASA that this was not simply a bid to get himself one last joyride in space. There has always been a relationship between studies on Earth and those in space, with terrestrial research helping humans travel faster and stay longer in orbit, while space research transforms the way that we live on the ground. In 1997, pointing out that many countries were wrestling with the issue of caring for their aging populations, Glenn's hope was that the space flight would have enormous benefit for, well, the graying of nations, they call it, all over the world. Microgravity, a near absence of gravity while in orbit, temporarily induces many of the effects of aging, even in younger crew members, though it appears these effects are largely reversible over time once the astronaut reaches the ground. Now, an exciting new area of investigation into this apparent accelerated aging, its underlying mechanisms, and possible preventative strategies could help both astronauts and seniors improve their resilience and decrease the risk of disease. Among the scientists conducting this research is Richard Hewson, the research chair in vascular aging and brain health at the Schlegel University of Waterloo Research Institute for Aging in Ontario. Since 2007, Hewson has spearheaded a series of four Canadian experiments to investigate in detail why astronauts age rapidly in space and what countermeasures can be put in place to prevent and reverse this sudden aging. He has found that during a six-month space mission, an astronaut's cardiovascular system can age by up to 10 or 20 years. The first study, which ran from 2007 to 2010, examined how the hearts and blood vessels of astronauts alter due to spaceflight. It followed six astronauts who strapped on devices that examined their heart rate, blood pressure, and physical activity in general 24-hour periods before, during, and after their mission. This allowed the investigation team to see how their systems changed in space and how exercise and other countermeasures, for example, wearing devices to adjust blood flow, would be helpful. The success of the study then spurred the Vascular series, which comprises three sets of experiments to date. The first, Vascular, looked at changes in the blood vessels and the heart over time, specifically examining how arteries change and stiffen as blood pressure alters due to less physical activity in space. Artery stiffening then came under even more scrutiny in Vascular Echo, which required astronauts to wear a leg cuff that shifted blood from the upper body to the lower body, better mimicking proper blood flow on Earth. Vascular Echo additionally monitored astronauts for a year post-flight to investigate how the body readjusts after a long-duration stay on the space station. The latest in the series, Vascular Aging, looks at how and when insulin resistance may happen during a space mission. It also examines how radiation exposure may affect cardiovascular health, and, like Vascular Echo, explores how well an astronaut recovers after coming back to Earth. Vascular Aging began collecting data in 2019 and will finish in 2024, according to the Canadian Space Agency. So far, the preliminary results from Vascular show that arteries of astronauts tend to stiffen by 17 to 30%. Astronauts may also be at increased risk of type 2 diabetes because they develop insulin resistance and have difficulties processing glucose. We are seeing astronauts coming back from space with carotid arteries that have aged the equivalent to 20 to 30 years in stiffness, Hewson told the Canadian Institutes of Health Research in a 2015 interview about Vascular. It is very comparable to what you would see in an aging population. An astronaut returning to Earth arrives much like a delicate senior who may have several health issues that prevent them from moving for long periods of time. After all, astronauts don't work very hard to move from place to place in space. Their lungs, without proper exercise, become deconditioned. Even the soles of their feet become soft from disuse as they float around. They'd be next to helpless upon landing on Earth without countermeasures in place, including a tailored exercise regime. The aim, for the first few months or so back on the ground, is to get the astronaut back to a typical state of middle age, able to drive, exercise, and actively participate in work and home activities, and continue contributing to research and other missions at NASA. After Christina Koch spent nearly a year in space, the agency published 10 ways in which the healthy 41-year-old might need to recover when coming back to Earth. Coming back meant, for example, that sleep would no longer be simple floating bliss, that smells would suddenly be frequent, and that sensory inputs like wind on the face would suddenly happen again. Changes to weight and balance were also taken into account. On Earth, we rely on our eyes and inner ear to maintain stability. In orbit, without gravity pulling down, the mind quickly stops listening to the inner ear. The eyes take over, and we rely solely on visual cues, Koch said in the article. From what I've been told, it takes a couple of days after landing for the mind to start listening again. The human body's ability to adapt to its environment is nothing less than impressive. The recovery from space actually begins as astronauts dress for the ride home. Both NASA and Roscosmos, the Russian space agency, use garments with lower body compression to assist with adjusting fluid shift. NASA continually refines the design by studying test subjects following a period of bed rest and, of course, spaceflight. The agency notes that the garment, also has applications for people on Earth who have a tendency to faint or experience difficulties in blood pressure. Even before they go to space, NASA establishes a baseline for each astronaut to customize their rehabilitation program for their return. In other words, they make sure to tailor the training so that the astronaut is at a level of capability after the recovery period that is similar to their fitness before traveling to space, rather than aiming for an idealized standard that may not be fit for all bodies. The rehabilitation period is lengthy, and numerous astronauts have pointed to the need to take it easy and receive assistance from family members during this delicate time, which can last months. Post-flight reconditioning begins on landing day, is scheduled for 2 hours per day, 7 days a week, for 45 days, and is tailored to the specific needs of the astronaut, reads a post-flight reconditioning brief on NASA's technical report server from 2011. Fortunately, the specialists assigned to help each astronaut recover have more than two decades of experience working with ISS crew and know that what sorts of countermeasures are required to keep the returning space flyers safe and healthy. For seniors, the implications cannot be clearer. There is more that must be done as people age to counter the effects of staying sedentary. Many doctors have pointed to the risk of sedentary work for industrial populations in general. But this newer research underlies the need not only for exercise, but for consistent exercise. We have ample evidence showing how dramatically younger astronauts age in space, and the research on reversing this aging can be applied to improve the health and lives of elderly people on Earth. But space-flying seniors remain a small and select group. The eldest so far, Wally Funk, 82, and William Shatner, 90, experienced suborbital flights of only a few minutes long in 2021. Both appeared energetic in media interviews post-landing, although detailed medical results were not disclosed. The longest senior stint in space so far still belongs to NASA's John Glenn, whose flight captivated the imaginations of young and old alike in 1998. At age 77, Glenn flew as a payload specialist on the STS-95 Space Lab mission, meaning that he was responsible for some of the many life science and microgravity experiments on board. All reports indicate that he was careful to contribute. A media report said he received good reviews for his work ethic and affability and didn't bother himself with the attendant celebrity that his name could have brought. On board the mission, he made sure to fulfill crew responsibilities of not just experiments, but also housekeeping and meal preparation. Glenn performed several experiments on himself in space, sometimes with the assistance of fellow astronaut Scott Parazynski, a medical doctor who was on board with him. Metabolism experiments had him swallowing one kind of amino acid in pill form and another by injection as proxies for hormonal changes caused by muscle atrophy or protein loss. X-ray studies recorded changes in lean body mass. Glenn also charted his sleep patterns on four nights, comparing the results of taking melatonin or placebo pills, and tracked his core body temperature with a mini thermometer embedded in a capsule he had swallowed. His brain waves were monitored using devices clamped to his scalp, wrist, and chest. And, like many other astronauts, he gave samples of blood and waste for analysis. The big questions today are which senior will be the next to participate in an extended orbital mission, and what new information may we collect from them? The key is to find someone willing to continue to participate in medical experiments, and to properly calibrate each result to match up with Glenn. Beyond ecotourism. Across Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, pools of azure water punch through the landscape like Swiss cheese. In many of these sinkholes, called cenotes, braided root systems and spiraling foliage descend multiple stories down limestone walls to soak in the oasis. Increasingly, however, the flora is sharing these cool waters with throngs of human visitors, swimming, snorkeling, or snapping selfies in the otherworldly setting. Geologically speaking, Mexico's cenotes are entry points to the Yucatan Peninsula's uniquely shallow and vital aquifer. They're entry points for tourists, too, as more and more of these natural marvels are developing into eco-park attractions, and travel across the region is projected to expand significantly as of 2024 due to an ambitious national train project. But the transportation effort, spearheaded by Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, is generating waves of controversy between local communities, the president, and conservationists. These tensions raise concerns that surface anywhere tourism, development, and science collide in the natural world. Humans have the capacity to love wild places to death, degrading them with excessive traffic and misuse. Yet tourism also wields the potential to draw funding and support for conservation. Environmental anthropologist Amanda Stronza has been studying the revolving door between tourism and conservation since her PhD work in the late 1990s. Her career has revealed no simple or perfect template under the umbrella of ecotourism, nor a consistent definition. Can we harness capitalist forces and the market for the good of conservation, she asks. It's a double-edged sword. While the word ecotourism was coined in the early 1980s, the concept itself, supporting conservation efforts in part by leveraging nature for leisure and directing revenue back to the ecosystem, stretches back more than a century. The U.S. National Park System was an early originator, designating wild places as protected areas. People pay to visit for relaxation or inspiration, and hopefully they gain appreciation for the flora and fauna that call it home. Ideally, these experiences in turn generate interest in protecting said places, as well as contributing immediate funding to do so. The dark side, of course, is the potential harm to what you're trying to protect. If you're only considering the land, animals, and plants, it's a simple answer. The activity of tourism is more damaging than no tourism at all, Stronza says. Some ideological purists go so far as to argue that each human must personally avoid flying at all costs, stop consuming foods beyond their immediate community, or scrutinize every print they leave on Earth. However, Stronza adds, that premise ignores a crucial element of reality. People are part of an ecosystem. They always have been, she says, underscoring how the anthropogenic use of nature stretches back tens of thousands of years. Today's complex economic systems add unique, meaningful opportunities to invest in nature, which can serve humans, animals, and landscapes alike. I care so much about wildlife, but I also see clearly the deep and intimate interactions between people and wild places and wildlife, she says. For instance, wild places and new experiences in them are a well of inspiration. Spending time in nature also is directly linked to improved mental health and physical well-being, as well as spiritual practices and other facets of life for many cultures. And history has demonstrated that humans are less likely to invest in protecting habitats and creatures if they share no personal connection to them. One 2016 study even linked the intervention of ecotourism to specific population increases in some endangered species, including preventing the likely extinction of orangutans in Sumatra, though it also did find a trade-off with negative impacts to other species and habitats. Ecotourism, then, has emerged as a potential bridge between outdoor experiences and conservation. The challenge for travelers is that this term typically lacks consistent parameters, regulations, and stipulations. Like the word natural in the grocery store, ecotourism often gets slapped on any flavor of nature-related fun and conventional tourism, according to Stronza and colleagues, who published a 2019 review on the matter, an annual review of environment and resources. This conundrum demands a bit more mindfulness and research from eco-conscious travelers grappling with the ethical question, should I stay or should I go? But resources abound once you know where and how to look. The following roundup of destinations and experiences offers some inspiration, lessons learned, and ongoing challenges, all in mesmerizing landscapes where tourists, scientists, and wild ecosystems are converging at a rapid pace. The Great Barrier Reef. The world's most extensive coral reef system, located in Australia, needs little introduction, but it could use a biological miracle to return to its glory days as a thriving ecosystem. For context, the Great Barrier Reef encompasses an area bigger than the UK, Switzerland, and Holland combined. It's home to some 600 known varieties of hard and soft corals, and many more species of fish and marine creatures, though these figures could decline as coral colonies continue to die off. The Great Barrier Reef itself has been the subject of many dire climate headlines over the past decade, particularly as the abundance of coral dropped by roughly 50% over just 30 years, according to a major study of the Great Barrier Reef published in 2020. Two back-to-back mass bleaching events in 2016 and 2017 did exceptional damage, followed by bleaching events in 2020 and 2022. The four occurrences have been attributed to stress due to changing surface temperatures in the ocean. One consistent challenge for this ecosystem, and all reefs globally, is that oceans absorb roughly 90% of the excess heat generated by greenhouse gas emissions in Earth's atmosphere. While this helps buffer and offset the rise of ambient air temperatures around the globe, it can deal deadly blows to reefs. And beyond bleaching events, which have been occurring more frequently, the impact of cyclones, diseases, and predatory crown-of-thorn starfish routinely threaten coral. As for direct human impact, besides warming caused by greenhouse gas emissions, degraded water quality and coastal development are significant issues, along with the localized risks of trampling coral, wildlife disturbance, or human pollution that can result from snorkeling and other recreation. Prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, roughly 2 million people visited the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park each year via tourism operations. While the pandemic nearly slashed that count in half, recent reports show traffic steadily rebounding. Many of these visitors participate in immersive diving, snorkeling, or boating day trips to encounter the marine life and coral. While that activity can certainly increase local degradation, regulated tourism is increasingly contributing to reef conservation, according to researchers with the Australian Institute of Marine Science, or AIMS, a government agency handling the longest-running and most comprehensive Great Barrier Reef monitoring program. Marine scientists need all the support they can get from the public in this endeavor, says AIMS coral biologist Kathy Page, when asked how tourists impact the reef. For starters, most visitors to the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park pay upon entry an environmental management fee that supports conservation efforts. At the start of 2020, that program was annually generating over $11 million in Australian dollars, nearly $8 million in U.S. dollars, of revenue, though the charge has been paused since the pandemic in 2020 to aid tourism recovery. Additionally, many partnerships have started unfolding between researchers, tourism operators, and islander locals who visit the reef daily and depend upon its health. In 2020, AIMS launched Boats for Corals as a means of scaling up larval reseeding across reefs. That project, led by Mark Gibbs, teaches tourism operators, recreational boaters, and indigenous islanders how to identify and collect coral spawn and grow baby corals in floating nurseries and settle them into their local damaged reefs. The Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority, which regulates and protects the Great Barrier Reef, also rolled out a Master Reef Guides program in February 2019. The effort instills high-standard tourism practices across the reef and involves a 5-day intensive workshop for guides. On a larger financial scale, the Australian government is currently making its biggest ever move to restore the Great Barrier Reef. Through a nearly $300 million U.S. dollar partnership with the Great Barrier Reef Foundation, this Reef Trust partnership involves more than 300 projects over a 6-year period, while incorporating many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, plus the booming tourism industry as engines of restoration and sustainability. Remarkably, despite a decade with significant coral mortality after 2016 and 2017, the Great Barrier Reef's hard corals have shown signs of recovery. Overall, hard coral coverage has increased across the key northern, central, and southern sections of the Great Barrier Reef, according to a 2021 condition report by AIMS. But the threat of bleaching events or other climate dangers always looms. while further research will continue to hone prevention and preservation strategies. We're only starting to scratch the surface in terms of understanding coral reefs and the impacts of humans on these ecosystems, says Page. Before booking tours and excursions, some reef advocates recommend seeking out businesses blazoned with EarthCheck or Ecotourism Australia certifications, which identify outfitters and accommodations that have made efforts towards sustainability. Though Stronza warns there are pros and cons to such programs, which often lack thorough assessment of participants and favor larger operations that can afford the fee for certification. As an alternative, more hands-on option, travelers can seek out citizen science experiences that might directly support marine life or reef restoration. Glacier tourism. Evidence across decades has documented the shrinking of famous glaciers in our warming climate. This reality makes glaciers a prime candidate for last chance tourism, where the pending disappearance of a structure or species drives intrigue and traffic. The irony, of course, is that traveling to such novelties often generates greenhouse gases or inflicts direct harms that accelerate their disappearance. One potential benefit to glaciers, you can admire them from a distance, at least for now, without any direct contact. Amazon exploration. Stronza recommends two destinations in South America as exemplary versions of sustainable, beneficial ecotourism: the Capawi Eco Lodge project in Ecuador and Posada Amazonas in Peru. Capawi, which is fully owned by the Achuar indigenous nation, offers multi-day rainforest hikes, family-style meals and tea ceremonies, plus lodging in traditional Achuar bungalows. In southeast Peru, Posada Amazonas immerses travelers in the indigenous culture and natural wonders of the Tambopata jungle, with 75% of the profits going to the Ese Eja native community of Infierno. Quaking clone. Utah's 106-acre quaking aspen grove, known for being one of the Earth's largest living organisms, is faltering. Pando's 40,000-plus trees are actually all genetically identical shoots from the same root system, but mule deer and cattle have been feeding on its new sprouts faster than the clone can regenerate itself. While fencing erected around several portions of the stand in response to the threat is effectively deterring hungry animals, ecologist Paul Rogers raised new concerns in a fall 2022 report in Conservation Science and Practice. The fencing approach has essentially divided the structure into ecologically divergent segments, he says. To preserve Pando and the ecosystem it supports, long-term conservation and restoration efforts are needed, including dynamic management of the species that are feasting on Pando's new generations. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slotkey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.